Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Michael Nock, Dean and Professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. We welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight we present a town hall discussion that will explore from numerous perspectives the current Middle East conflict involving Lebanon, Israel, Hezbollah, and indirectly the countries of Syria and Iran. This conflict seems to be part of an unending cycle of violence in the Middle East. While it is easy to get mired in questions over how all this began and who started it, it is important to turn our attention to the present and the future. What can we do about the situation, and where might that region be headed? Will the current diplomatic efforts at the UN translate to any kind of lasting peace on the ground? And where should the international community go from here to help ease tensions, stop the violence, and open a dialogue? To help address these questions, we are joined by the following panelists. Asad Abu Khalil was born in Lebanon and is professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus and visiting professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He is also the creator of the Angry Arab News Service website. Professor Abu Khalil holds a PhD from Georgetown University and a BA and MA from American University of Beirut. He returned from Lebanon on July 10th, where he conducted a month-long research project and interviewed various leaders and officials, including the leader of Hezbollah. Professor Abu Khalil holds Israel fully responsible for the current war and its consequences. David Beal is professor of Jewish history at the University of California at Davis. He holds a PhD from UCLA and has served as director of the Center for Jewish Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. He's also been visiting professor at UC Santa Cruz, UCLA, Haifa University, and the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He is an expert on the history and politics of modern Israel. Thomas Dine is chief executive officer of the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma counties. He also previously served for 8 years as president of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Prague. Prior to that, he headed the Clinton administration's Foreign Economic Assistance Program for the former Soviet Union and Central and Eastern Europe as assistant administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development. And prior to that, was executive director of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Fred Lawson is professor of government at Mills College. He has also been Fulbright lecturer in international relations at the University of Aleppo and at Aden University. Dr. Lawson is a noted expert on Syria. Glenn E. Robinson is associate professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Dr. Robinson has traveled widely in the Middle East, has studied at a number of universities in the area, including Hebrew University of Jerusalem, University of Jordan in Amman, and the American University in Cairo. He was an exchange student in Iran in 1978 and believes that the current Lebanon war will restructure the Middle East for years to come, but in surprising ways, not always in American interests. In order to begin the discussion, I have posed one question to each panelist. The panelists will have 3 to 4 minutes to respond in any way they see fit. The opening question is Professor Abu Khalil. A 1992 Hezbollah statement reads, "It is an open war until the elimination of Israel, until the death of the last Jew on earth." Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah stated earlier this year, "There is no solution to the conflict in this region except with the disappearance of Israel." Please comment on these statements with reference to the conflict that has just ended.
Well, I've decided to do the following. I did not like that question one bit, and I will respond to it, but I will do so after I begin my opening remarks. So my second intervention will respond to that question. First, I need to say that my view is that I do not think this war began on July 12th with the capture of the two Israeli soldiers. I don't even think this began with the war against Hezbollah. This is way too old. This started long before there was Hezbollah, long before fundamentalism existed in my part of the world. I've heard it all before. The same propaganda clichés, the same generalizations, the same justification for the killing of civilians. But this started throughout my own life. I was born in 1960. I am from the city of Tyre, deeply rooted with my family in that city. But I will spare you any personal stories of agony or suffering because I know the rules of the game in the United States. I know that Arabs are not entitled to emotions or to tears or to funerals. These are the prerogatives of Israelis. So I will stick to the topic at hand. Let us see what Israel has done to Lebanon before there was Hezbollah. Let us cite the figures. All of them are either UN figures or Lebanese government figures from the 1960s, long before Hezbollah existed, to remind you, and some of them long before there was PLO. Between 1949 and 1964, this is prior to the launching of the Palestinian resistance movement, there were registered some 140 Israeli attacks on Lebanese villages and towns. In 1950, Israeli planes downed a Lebanese civilian airliner. In 1959 alone, Israeli forces hijacked three planes. Between 1968 and 1974, the Lebanese government registered 3,000 attacks on Lebanon, which resulted in the murder of 880 Lebanese and Palestinian civilians. What? You didn't think we count our dead? We do. With their names and with their faces. So I will say that all these propaganda clichés we've heard, I've heard them in 1982 when I barely survived the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. My grandfather's house in the city of Tyre, at the risk of being anecdotal, my grandfather is a dead man. He was the mayor of the city of Tyre in the 1930s in the French Mandate. With every attack on Lebanon, that house, which I partially own to this day, has been bombarded. Has been bombarded in 1978, in 1982, and I haven't checked what happened to it in the last campaign on Lebanon. But the question that many Arabs pose, and it's a legitimate question, is the following. Even if we agree, and we should agree, that the killing of civilians, whether they are Jewish or Muslims, Israelis or Arabs, should be absolutely condemned and rejected. But that's not the question because we don't agree on that. Because we find that there is more sympathy for Israelis who kill civilian Arabs than there is for civilian Arabs who die. What I mean by this is the following. There is in the American media more articles expressing sympathy and support and solidarity with Israeli soldiers than there is with the civilians who die from Israeli bombs. So there is something wrong when the Israeli killers in this case are seen more sympathetically than the Palestinians or Lebanese civilians. But the question is, how many Arab civilians, forget about those that you label as terrorists, whether they are fundamentalists, left-wingers, communists, socialists, Israel brands them all as terrorists. How many of those Arabs have to die before we label Israeli killing of those Arabs as terrorism? Israel speaks about those justification in a language that is exactly that of bin Laden and al-Qaeda. They say the same, hiding behind civilians that we didn't intend to, we are against this. But I will say the following. I do not have to wait for Human Rights Watch reports, and a new report just came out today, which basically ruled out, and I'm not sympathetic to Human Rights Report, they are way too timid about Israel, in which they said that Israeli justification about missiles from those houses are absolutely not to be accepted. I have seen it in 1982 when I lived during the Israeli invasion, the bombing of civilians, torture of underage people, shooting at crowds, humiliation of people of all people. I will say the premise of all that is a racist premise of Zionism. The notion that Arabs are not equal to the Israeli Jews, and as a result, all manner of degradation of those people, of their killing, is to be accepted and is to be justified. After the year 2000, and that's the last minute I have, after the year 2000, you may say, what happened? Who broke those agreements? Well, as was mentioned in the introduction, I was just in Lebanon and I interviewed scores of people, including government officials and the Speaker of the Lebanese Parliament, who supplied me with this figure based on UN officials. After the year 2000, Hezbollah is guilty of violating the blue line on the Israeli-Lebanese border 100 times. Israel, according to UN figures, violated that line 11,782 times. So who is responsible for the deaths and for the destruction? You speak of kidnapping. Israel has been in the habit of kidnapping Lebanese at will. A fisherman from my hometown of Tyre, Mohammed Farran is his name, is still missing. In February of this year, Israel shot at a shepherd and killed him. You see, they don't register in your media because they are inferior humans. They are not the expensive humans that you hear about. Violation of human rights, of the blue line, Israel has been doing that by land, by sea, and by air almost daily, according to UN reports. And earlier this year, the Lebanese government cracked, the pro-Bush Lebanese government, cracked a network of terrorists in Lebanon, which is responsible for car bombs throughout the country, and killed in February two Lebanese individuals in the city of Sidon. Landmines, in 2000, when Israel was forced to humiliatingly withdraw from Lebanese resistance against their forces, they refused to surrender to the Lebanese government a map of the more than 400,000 landmines that Israel left behind. This is not counting the mines they left here. Plus, they also occupy parts of South Lebanon. With that in mind, it seems to me it's obvious that many Arabs don't even have to ponder who is responsible for the war and the destruction and all the killing that occurred in Lebanon and beyond. Thank you.
Professor Beal, there's been a lot of criticism of Israel's military approach to the war. But given Israel's difficulties in fighting with ground forces in Lebanon from 1982 to 2000 and the global criticism against Ariel Sharon for the actions taken in that conflict, wasn't it sensible tactically and politically for Prime Minister Olmert to begin the conflict primarily with an air campaign?
Well, I don't think you can wave a magic wand to turn a historian into a retired general. So I'm not sure I have the military expertise to answer that question, but since I'm a professor, I'm happy to speak on any subject, and I will try to answer that. Before I do, though, I'd like to actually say something in terms of to try to understand on the Israeli side the context, or one of the contexts in which they decided to respond as they did on July 12th. There are a number of contexts, including their anxieties about Iran and so forth, but this is one that is, I think, coming more and more to the fore. And we need to go back to March of this year. The Israeli elections produced a government which was elected on the basis of Prime Minister Olmert's so-called convergence plan, that is a plan to withdraw from substantial portions of the West Bank. And Olmert declared that he would do so either in negotiation with the Palestinians, or if they didn't produce a negotiating partner, then he would do it unilaterally. Now, in response to this in May, President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority did something that was actually quite bold. It was a kind of a political coup in which he did an end run around Hamas and called for a plebiscite on a so-called prisoner's document, which, although it didn't fully recognize Israel, it nevertheless pointed in the direction of a kind of two-state solution. Now, this put Hamas in a real dilemma, and the political wing of Hamas was trying to figure out exactly how to respond to this. The military wing, together with some other rejectionist groups, dug a tunnel under the Gaza fence, staged a raid on an Israeli unit in which it killed two soldiers and kidnapped one. Now, we now know, based on reporting by Seymour Hersh, which you can read in The New Yorker, that Israeli signals intelligence had picked up conversations between Hamas, Hezbollah, and Syria, in which apparently there was an agreement that if Hamas did something like this, the Hezbollah was supposed to heat up the northern front. And it's on that background that the Hamas action took place on July 12th, or at least so it seemed to the Israelis. I'm not going to presume to know what what Hezbollah was thinking when it staged that raid over the international border on July 12th. But from the Israeli point of view, it was understood that this was the reason that it happened. And so the launching of the war by Olmert was in part to protect his convergence plan. And he declared as much during the war, which actually had the ironic result that a couple of settlers in the West Bank said that if that was the case, they would refuse to serve in the reserves. So clearly was taken seriously. As it happened, one of the casualties of the war, of the Israeli failure in the war, has probably been the convergence plan. So it typically, this typically happens that wars produce very unintended consequences. Now let me turn to the question of bombing. Here I think actually it's probably better that I'm not a retired general because generals always want to bomb. Historically, we know that bombing almost never works, and especially doesn't work against irregular forces. We can go back to the Spanish Civil War, and we can see time and again that what bombing tends to do, it tends to consolidate the opinion of the people being bombed. So Israel thought that by bombing the civilian infrastructure in Lebanon, it would get Lebanese to turn against Hezbollah, and of course the exact opposite is what happened. So the bombing, I think, was a very, very bad idea on military grounds, on political grounds. It, as we know, creates a lot of civilian casualties. That's inevitable, no matter how precise your weapons are, especially when you're dealing with an irregular force that is situated among the civilian population. And it creates a international backlash, which is exactly what happened. If it wasn't for the Bush administration dragging out the war, then there would have been a ceasefire a lot earlier because of the bombing. So I think that was a very bad mistake from Israel's point of view. Where we go in the future, we can turn to and discuss later in answer to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dine, why do you believe that Israel has been so roundly criticized in much of the world press for killing innocent civilians, even if some of these civilians were shielding Hezbollah forces?
The question actually follows your previous question, and I'm in very much agreement with what Professor Beal said about the history of bombing. The history of bombing actually is messy, dangerous, inaccurate, but it also can stop wars, as in World War II, with the destruction of Dresden, which has now become a focal point about in terms of discussion, a vigorous discussion in Germany. It basically led to the surrender of the Nazi forces. The same in Japan with the firebombing of Tokyo. As cruel as that may be, even crueler was the use of nuclear weapons. So, yes, bombing is cruel, but now we get to the second part of your question, which is, are civilians who host armaments, combat forces, are they really innocent? And I'm sure there's going to be, over the years, a legal bibliography that will get longer and longer as these wars continue. But in fact, they certainly are ethical as well as practical dilemmas. This war, in its conduct, reminds me of the NATO war against Kosovo, against the Serbs in Kosovo and around Kosovo, where NATO didn't want to lose ground forces, resisted General Clark's call for ground forces. Finally, the Clinton administration bowed to the NATO commander's desire, and Milosevic got the message and basically surrendered a couple of days later. So bombing is awful. It's heartbreaking. It can cause enormous destruction to those who are engaged or not engaged in the combat in various ways. Now, the first speaker doesn't want to acknowledge self-defense. He doesn't even want to really acknowledge a longer history than he indicated. Ever since Jews from Europe started coming to Palestine in the 19th century, late in the 19th century, and purchased land from Ottoman landowners, there's been hostility aimed at them. So to say that this war didn't start on July 12th, in many ways, you're right. It's been going on a long time. But now we're at a point where mature people have to come together and try to figure out what do we do with the fact that there is a nation state called Israel, there is a nation state called Lebanon, which now twice or three times has been taken over by states within a state, and it causes enormous problems, obviously. But I would contend that Israel's ferocity in going after Hezbollah, following what took place in Gaza with the kidnapping, and then the kidnapping in the north, and the eight soldiers being killed in a reconnaissance vehicle in Israel, has to do with what every government has to do to show its legitimacy, defend its borders. And once those borders were crossed by Hezbollah on July 12th, that added to the motion, what Olmert set into motion. And I also agree with what Professor Beal said about Olmert's political imperative. He ran on a risky campaign note. Every politician who runs on a peace platform of some kind, however it's interpreted, must show strength in a different kind of way. We can go through the last eight American presidents, and many of us live those events in one form or another. So the legitimacy of Israel, the nation state, the legitimacy of the Olmert government, even though it got a very large, for Israel, political mandate, was at stake. And so then began Israel's offensive, exercising its right to self-defense. So I would say that the first answer to your question is air war only has a certain time period in which it will be tolerated. The second answer is, in the television age particularly, that time span is quite limited. And I remember during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, going after the PLO, George Will, nationally syndicated columnist, wrote a column saying that Lincoln could never have conducted the Civil War in an age of television. Third, I believe that the international media, worldwide media, in its depiction of the Israelis in a very unfriendly way, has to do with the fact that Israel is fair game. There are plenty of people, and we heard it tonight, who do not accept the existence of the State of Israel. And there's a hostility that is felt throughout the worldwide Jewish community in this regard. And interestingly to me, since I lived through the 1982 Lebanon incursion, unlike then, the diaspora Jewish community, whether it's Australia, Argentina, here, Canada, Europe, is solidly behind Israel in its actions, and that will have its effect. And I've been receiving polite desires to end my little. So the first reason is air power and how it creates criticism. The second is conducting war with TV coverage. By the way, I spent 8 years trying to get our correspondents, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty correspondents, into Chechnya. And the Russians have a way of dealing in this modern age. You keep out the press, totally, except your own. And therefore, what the slaughter that has been taking place in Chechnya over the last several years has not been really depicted. And finally, I would say that Israel is seen, particularly in the Arab world, the Muslim world, even in the unfriendly part of Europe toward the United States, is Israel is America's surrogate in this day and age, and therefore the criticism of Israel is criticism of the United States.
Thank you. Professor Lawson, Syria has played an important role in this conflict. But historically, Egypt and Jordan, through arduous negotiations with Israel involving American mediation, were able to respectively reacquire their land in exchange for peace with Israel. Why has Syria not pursued this same approach to reclaim the Golan Heights?
In the very twilight of the Clinton administration, in 1999-2000, the United States mobilized itself to try to broker some sort of peace negotiations between Israel and Syria. Partly, this effort paid off because the Israeli government made it signaled that Israel might be willing to re-enter these negotiations and talk about the border that existed between Syria and Israel as of the day before the Six-Day War of 1967 broke out. And this was a long-time Syrian demand, that Israel start with the borders, deal with the borders that were in place as of June 4th, 1967. Partly the effort paid off as well because President Hafez al-Assad of Syria signaled that he was willing to sit down and bargain seriously with the State of Israel. And he was primarily interested in starting up negotiations, in his words, where the talks had broken off. So the Syrians didn't want to lose the decade worth of negotiation that had gone on before the year 2000. The Clinton administration had very many other things on its mind. And in the memorable words of William Quant, the Clinton administration had pretty much ignored the Middle East for most of its time in office. And in Bill Quant's words, the Clinton people tried to pull an all-nighter right at the very end and get the two sides together. I noticed the professors are laughing at this term, all-nighter. The audience is not. And tried to get the two sides together to work out some arrangement just before the Clinton administration leaves office. And so in January of 2000, Syrian representatives and Israeli representatives do meet together with U.S. officials in Shepherdstown, Maryland, and the Syrians are immediately disappointed because it becomes clear from the very beginning that the Israelis are not really going to bargain on the basis of the border that was in place the day before the June War, but in fact are interested in a different kind of border, and the precise definition, the precise delineation of the border remains in dispute between the two sides. It also becomes clear in January of 2000 that the Israelis are demanding complete access to the water rights of the Golan, and the Syrians don't want to go into the negotiations already ceding water rights in the Golan to the Israeli side. So the Syrians are deeply disappointed. The talks drag on for about 3 months, but in the context of escalating tensions between Israel and Hezbollah in March of the year 2000, the Israeli side pulls out of the talks and goes home. At the end of the year, Syrian President Hafez al-Assad makes a couple of other signals that he would like to renew the talks. These signals are generally ignored, and President Hafez al-Assad dies unexpectedly then in June of 2000. During the first weeks that the new president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is in office, he also sends signals that the Syrians are interested in renewing the talks with Israel, also renewing the talks on the basis of where they had broken off before. But at the end of October, the year 2000, the Israeli government began building 1,500 new houses for Jewish settlers on the Golan. In February of 2001, then, Prime Minister Ehud Barak was turned out of office and was replaced by the much more hard-line Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Nevertheless, the Syrians continued to signal that they would like in some way for the talks to begin again. They would like in some way to work out some U.S. brokered arrangement between the two sides. Nevertheless, the talks between the two sides never get back together. Now, the spinmeisters on both sides have worked out a variety of reasons why the two sides never got together. Inside accounts don't leave us too much more illuminated than press reports leave us about why the two sides never got together. But one important reason why this particular episode of Syrian-Israeli negotiations broke down was that the U.S. administration changed. The U.S. administration found other things on its mind. The U.S. administration was not able to continue as a broker between the two sides. I'm sure you all noticed that the question we were given sort of implies that a lot of the onus for negotiations breaking down between Syria and Israel lies on one side or the other. The story is more complicated than that, and there's certainly a third actor that was not asked in the question, that is Washington's role in trying to somehow work out groundwork for the talk between Syria and Israel.
Thank you. Professor Robinson, since most of the Muslim and Arab world is Sunni, not Shia, are there not real constraints on the influence Iran will be able to wield in restructuring the Middle East?
Thank you. Well, Professor Beal suggested that as professors we're free to speak with authority on any subject. Let me also suggest that there's a good professorial answer to the question, which is, it depends. The Sunni-Shia divide is complicated. It's complex. It changes. It varies from place to place. It varies over time. What one finds, for example, in Saudi Arabia is a lot different in terms of hostility, particularly Sunni-Wahhabi hostility towards the Shia, versus what you might find in Lebanon, where the history of Sunni-Shia relations are quite a bit better, frankly. And again, it will change over time. The rule of thumb, however, trying to tie it into tonight's topic, the rule of thumb is that the hotter the Arab-Israeli conflict gets, the less important sectarian divides are in the Muslim world. The less important the Shia-Sunni divide becomes when things are hot on the ground, as they have been, obviously, the last couple of months. Let me just give you a real-world example of that. I returned a couple of days ago this weekend from 2 weeks in Yemen. Now, Yemen does not have, as to my knowledge, an Ithna Ashari Shi'i presence. In other words, the dominant form of Shi'i Islam that one finds in Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon does not exist in Yemen. There are a couple of small offshoot Shi'i sects, Zaydi and Ismaili, which are small. In other words, most of the people in Yemen are Shafi'i Sunni Muslims. As far as I could tell, every single car and minibus in Yemen had at least one picture of Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah posted on the back window or the side window. Nasrallah's picture was omnipresent in all the shops in the old city, and I got an earful, let me tell you, from some people passing by. In other words, Sunni Muslims had made Nasrallah, a Shiite, Shi'i Muslim, a sheikh from Lebanon, not into a Sunni hero, but into an Arab national hero. And he had become that Arab national hero in a pretty faraway region in the Arab world, in Yemen. And from my conversations and information from other places, that same pattern repeated itself in many different countries, many different Sunni-oriented countries. So again, when things are hot on the ground, the sectarian divide matters, frankly, a whole lot less. The last point by way of introduction is to suggest that in spite of what are sometimes real divides between Sunni and Shia in the Middle East, Iran has come out of this conflict, I think, the big winner. I mean, not that there's ever really winners in this kind of a thing, but if one were to point to winners and losers, I think Iran is the big winner. And that's in spite of the fact, again, that it is predominantly a Shia country. And I would suggest that Syria and Hezbollah are also, in various ways, also have come out winners. in this conflict, and a lot of their Sunni counterparts from the government of Lebanon, for example, and other Western-oriented governments in the Middle East have lost ground. They've lost some points, as well as, I think, and we can talk about that, Israel and the United States, predominantly Israel's deterrence capability, has taken a big hit over the last month. So the Sunni-Shia divide does matter. But how it matters and when it matters really depends from place to place and time to time. And I think at this point in time, it doesn't matter a whole lot in the Middle East.
Thank you very much. Let me remind the radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our subject is the current conflict in the Middle East. And our panelists for this discussion are Asad Abu Khalil, Professor of Political Science at California State University Stanislaus, David Beal, Professor of Jewish History at the University of California, Davis, Thomas Dine, Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma Counties, Fred Lawson, Professor of Government at Mills College, and Professor Glenn E. Robinson, Associate Professor of Defense Analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Could I ask, would any of the panelists like to say something further or ask a panelist another question? Professor Abu Khalil.
I think that's what I wanted to answer, the question that you posed to me. I have 5 points about it. One, I wouldn't have been bothered by that question if a similar one was asked about bigoted anti-Muslim, anti-Arab statements that are made casually by Israeli leaders. Two, I don't know why the question was posed to me. I do not believe I represent Hezbollah here, unless they now appoint anarchists to represent them. But perhaps the assumption is that they are all Arabs, they must be all Hezbollah, they must be all Palestinians. And the danger of that assumption, which has been a common theme in Israeli practices, is to lump them all together to justify all acts of violence against all of them. Three, the assumption is that every Arab should account for the deeds and utterances of every and other Arab, which is exactly like classical anti-Semitism. Classical anti-Semites wants every Jewish person to be held responsible for the deeds of every Jewish person anywhere in the world. So we should reject anti-Semitism and similar bigotry against Arabs and Muslims. Four, the premise is that the statements that were made in 1992, I don't know if they were made, by the way, because now I get the assumption or the impression that every American supporter of Israel is fluent in Arabic, because they now cite from me Arabic statements are made, but I know they are generated by an outfit in Washington, D.C. called Memory. Go to the website of theguardian.co.uk to know about its history, founded by a former intelligence official of the Mossad, and it generates translations that are highly unrepresentative by Arabs. So the assumption is that the statement that was made in 1992 triggered the conflict, while I argued with you that, in fact, it started well before that, and I have no problem in going as early as Thomas Dine wants us to go, because it seems to me there's clear evidence that every single nasty, sinister tool of terrorism was employed, pioneered into the conflict by Zionist forces. Five, offensive words by Arabs, and of course there are offensive words that are made by Arabs, seem to me, to Western American sensibilities, far more offensive than offensive actions and deeds against human beings. So in the standards of the United States media and dominant culture, a bigoted statement by an Arab is more deadly and lethal than a bomb that is dropped on a house full of children. That's my answer to the question.
Okay. Thank you. We have a large number of questions from the audience, more than we can possibly address in the time permitted. Some of them cluster around particular topics, so let me start with a couple. A few pose questions about American policy in the region and with the conflict. Here are two coupled questions. One is, how are U.S. interests served by a war between Israel and Hezbollah? And somewhat related to that, aside from evacuation of Americans, What are the potential ways would the U.S. military possibly be deployed in the region? Is there anyone who would like to respond to either of those questions? Professor Beal?
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to, again, an article that I cited earlier by Seymour Hersh, which I found rather chilling. His sources tell him, both American government and Israeli sources, that from the American point of view, this war was seen as a kind of a trial run for a bombing war on Iran. And what's interesting about that, I mean, aside from the fact that it's scary, is that the conclusion one ought to come to, I think, if one is evaluating the possibility of a bombing campaign on Iran, is that it's not going to work. It didn't work for the Israelis, and it certainly won't work for the Americans in Iran. And yet, apparently, the way in which this war is being interpreted by people in the administration is that, in fact, it succeeded, and President Bush himself, in a kind of parody of his own mission accomplished speech, gave a press conference the day after the ceasefire went into effect, in which he said that Hezbollah lost. If that's what they think, then I think we're in for something very, very scary. So, you know, it may be now that Iran has apparently made some kind of response to the UN's offers in terms of the nuclear program that perhaps, you know, this kind of war will be avoided. But I think that it's interesting to see how the war might be interpreted in terms of other interests.
Let me, if I may, just add a couple of comments. My own take on this is American national interests have been hurt by this conflict. And let me just run down a few. First of all, the U.S. enjoys a very close relationship with Israel. Israel's deterrence capability has taken a big hit over the last month, that a non-state actor was basically able to fight in its own asymmetrical way by far the most powerful military in the region to a standstill after more than a month. So future enemies of Israel will learn a lesson from that, and I'm not sure that's a lesson that Israel wanted to have learned, which is why right now there's an awful lot of infighting within the Israeli political establishment, sort of assigning the blame for who failed in this conflict. Second, the Lebanese government. This was a very strong pro-U.S. government in Beirut that had basically made the bargain with this is the Hariri camp in general, had made the bargain with the Lebanese people, saying, look, if we ride the coattails of Washington, that will lead to the exodus of Syrian troops from Lebanon, and that Washington will protect Lebanon from both Syrian interference and Israeli interference, which, of course, is historically Israel and Syria have fought their own proxy wars in Lebanon. This government has taken a huge hit. It will not be able to go back to its constituency in Lebanon and make that same pledge. Those words are now hollow. So the Lebanese government is going to end up basically opening the doors back to Syrian influence in a way that it thought it was rid of 2 months ago. And I don't think that's in U.S. interest. The Iranians and the Syrians have come out, if not smelling like roses, at least their status, their position in the region is more powerful today than it was 2 months ago. It's their proxies, and it's their guys that have come out well by regional standards. And I'm not sure that's in Washington's interest. And Hezbollah, I mean, look at Hezbollah has been drifting over the last year internally within Lebanon, trying to find its political place in the absence of the Syrian protector that had been Hezbollah's great protector, if you will, within the Lebanese political establishment. It was adrift, trying to find out, in a sense, what it wanted to do. It had been, to some degree, marginalized domestically within Lebanon. And what this conflict has done has cemented Hezbollah's place within domestic Lebanese politics and by extension brought in greater Syrian influence again into Lebanese domestic politics. And I'm not sure that's in America's interests either.
However, could I?
Yes.
All of the above is, or what we just heard is very true. But it reminds me of a game that's played in Washington a lot, which is who's up and who's down. And it goes by the week, if not sometimes by the day. In this case, I agree that Iran is up. But Iran is now in a picture frame that any American person concerned with policy has to look at and try to figure out what to do with. And so I think the debate in Washington, on our campuses, among our intellectuals, others, are going to focus more on what to do about Iran, if there's anything that can be done. And maybe this will reinforce those Americans who do not want to be unilateralists, but in fact multilateralists, and will work through the UN system with our allies in Europe and elsewhere. So it's you never say anybody's down, particularly in politics. You wonder how they're going to come back. And I think over the next couple of months, if not longer, we're going to see more debate about what to do about Iran. And then we get to November 08, and whoever wins that election and who occupies the White House will have to deal with a nuclear-oriented Iran.
Thank you. That was Tom Dine speaking, and the preceding speaker was Professor Robinson. A couple of reminders, one for the audience here at the club. I encourage you to go to the microphone if you wish to ask a question directly. And a reminder to the panel that tonight's topic is where do we go from here, and you are encouraged to address the future, not the past. There are several questions for Professor Abu Khalil. One of them reads as follows. If you were the leader of Israel, what would you do to solve the problem, long-term and short-term?
That's a legitimate question. And let me say to you, I have been, since my young days, many Arabs become converted into support of the Palestinians, especially if they happen to inhabit neighboring countries of Israel, by virtue of what Israel does, of the damage and the suffering that's inflicted on the civilian population of those countries. So I grew up in Lebanon, as you know, and I'm from South Lebanon. And I have always, however, been a strong, firm believer of coexistence of Jews and Arabs in the land of Israel, in the land of Palestine, throughout the Middle East. And it seems to me, since I am, on the long term, am a believer of a strong, secular, democratic state in all of that land, I don't care what it's even called, because I am not a nationalist personally, but I believe in restitution of national rights, especially of people. Thomas Dine is right. The Palestinian did not enjoy the fact that Zionism was establishing a state on an already existing nation. That's true. But they were not the first to employ weapons of violence against their enemies. In fact, if you go through the list, bombs in cafes were first used by Zionists in Palestine in 1937. Bombs on buses by Zionists in 1937, September. Bombs in marketplaces by Zionists on July 6, 38 in Haifa. Bombs of hotel by Zionists in 1946. Bombing of foreign embassies by Zionists in 1946 in Rome. Mining of ambulances, first by Zionists in 1946. 1947, the first letter bombs by Zionists. So if it's true, and it is true, there are some Arabs who engage in acts of terrorism, they learned at the feet of the masters, and that is Zionism. And if we are to basically preach a message where all Arabs and Jews can coexist together with the full return of Palestinian refugees, and that is something I so insist upon, because any other solution would be a travesty of justice. However, that is becoming far more remote. So the idea that I so cherish of Arab-Jewish coexistence in the region, and I am also for the return of Jewish refugees to all Arab countries from which some of them either left under duress or under whatever conditions, and even their restitution and their compensation. But all that is becoming a mirage. All that is becoming a mirage by virtue of what Israel has done to the Palestinians and to the Arabs. In my own lifetime, I'm 46 years old, Israel has bombed the following countries. I know all of them are terrorists. Tunisia, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Iraq. And in 1973, downed a Libyan civilian airliner. And, of course, chased Arabs throughout the world, including killing a waiter in 1973 in Norway because he resembled the picture of a Palestinian leader. So with that in mind, if I were in charge of Israel, I would certainly relinquish the use of force against Arab as a method. Hannah Arendt said back in 1950 in an article in the Journal of Politics, and she is a Zionist and helped Jewish refugees from Europe. And Hannah Arendt wrote in that article, she was observing on the fact that many Zionists were saying the only language we can deal with those barbarians, and that's a reference to the Arabs, is the language of force, which is the same advice that Bernard Lewis gave to George W. Bush upon embarking on the war in Iraq. And Hannah Arendt said back then, I do not understand the Zionists who chant that slogan. She said, if anything, if you look at the first 50 years of the Arab-Israeli conflict of the history of Zionism, you realize there is one language that the Arabs do not understand, and that is the language of force. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. One more question that I've received, and then we'll go to members of the audience, and that is a question about the Shia of northeast Saudi Arabia. Are they susceptible to Iranian influence?
I suppose that's directed to me.
This is Professor Robinson.
Shortly after the Iranian revolution of 78-79, there were clear ties between the revolutionary government in Tehran and Shi'i communities throughout the Gulf. And there's a very large Shia population that surrounds the Persian Gulf. If you add up the populations of Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, and Oman, about three out of every four people in that region actually is a Shi'i, not a Sunni. So there were a number of incidents in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain as well, in the late 70s, early 80s. But in general, the Shi'i community in Saudi Arabia has gone out of its way to support the regime, to be good citizens in Saudi Arabia. And the reason for that is quite obvious, is that the regime is the protector of the Shia against the more severe Wahhabi influence that you would find in Saudi Arabia. That, you know, frankly, it's not difficult to find Wahhabi preachers in Saudi Arabia that will say openly that the Shia are heretics and should all be burned at the stake. So the regime is the protector of the Shia, and in general, the Shia in the eastern province have reciprocated by being good citizens of Saudi Arabia.
Let me add one word on that.
This is Professor Abu Khalil.
In fact, over the last month, almost on biweekly basis, demonstrations by Shiite against the government in support of Lebanon have been registered and have been typically in Saudi Arabia, oppressed by the government. So in fact, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the calculation of this war in Lebanon was based on the assumption that is shared by a combination of an unholy alliance, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Al-Qaeda, who all believe in dividing Sunnis and Shiites. But as Glenn said earlier, all this, in fact, unified Sunnis and Shiites in ways that have been imaginable. In Al-Azhar University, the center of Sunni higher learning in Cairo, for the first time in the history of that place, there were pictures of a Shiite cleric, Hassan Nasrallah, that were held. And this is the thing. You have to give it to Israel and America. They are so much good. They excel in empowering their enemies. Israel did it with the PLO, and Israel is doing it today with Hezbollah.
Just a reminder to our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our subject is the current conflict in the Middle East, And our panelists for this discussion are Professor Asad Abu Khalil of California State University Stanislaus, Professor David Beal of the University of California at Davis, Mr. Thomas Dine, Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco Peninsula, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma Counties, Professor Fred Lawson of Mills College, and Professor Glenn E. Robinson of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Now turning to some questions from our audience here at the club. Yes, sir.
Thank you. A quick question for Professor Abu Khalil, but before that, a quick comment.
Very briefly, please.
It'll be very brief. The prize for tonight's most morally bankrupt statement goes to Thomas Dine for quoting, "All civilians who host combat forces are questioning whether all civilians who host combat forces are innocent." That's just a simple violation of the Geneva Conventions and international law. My question goes to Dr. Abu Khalil. Again, Mr. Dine talked about maybe in 2008 we'll be dealing with a nuclear-oriented Iran, and this is a serious question for you, sir. How should the Middle East region deal with a nuclear-oriented Israel and an Israel that is unwilling to allow for the establishment of a Palestinian state at the 1967 borders?
Let me say that I did notice that line that was slipped in Thomas Dine's talk, but I think, you know, he is of the view that Geneva Convention, I guess, should be amended. He should speak for himself. But my take on that was he doesn't believe in the Geneva Convention, and if that's the case, I think you should, along with everybody who supports you, petition it to allow the deliberate killing of civilians in times of war, of course justified in various ways that Israel as well as Al-Qaeda do very casually. On the question you asked, that's a very legitimate question because this is something that people ask. I mean, notice the discourse that's now being taking place on Lebanon. Israel is asking that Hezbollah be disarmed because Israel tried to go to battle against armed Hezbollah, and of course Israel being a superior army supplied by the United States, and American policy is that Israel should always be superior militarily and technologically, not to any Arab army, but to combination of all Arab armies. But Israel, having not enjoyed going to battle with an army that it used to call the ragtag army of Shiite fundamentalists, they now want them to be disarmed so that the next time around, Israel wants to do what it does best, going to battle against a largely defenseless population, which it does on a daily basis in Gaza and the West Bank. Arabs don't look at it that way because Arabs tend to notice what you don't notice, that Israel has a lethal arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. You can look at the Wisconsin Project, American Federation of Scientists. I mean, it's all tabulated except in the statements of American officials. Israel has an arsenal, massive nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. And I know, that you believe that in the hands of Israel they are harmless, but when those fall in the hands of Arabs and Muslims, the world should be beware. Arabs don't look at it that way. And it seems to me the quest by Arabs and Muslims to attain parity with Israeli deadly arsenal is going to continue. In fact, I argue, even if you have democracy, it will expedite the search and quest by Arabs for that. I mean, of course, that's not a pleasant scenario. Instead, we should aspire to a place where all these weapons should be abolished and dismantled, whether in the hands of Arabs or Israelis.
Thank you. May I say a word?
Yes. Quick. I mean, one of the things I think One of the things I think the United States is going to have to figure out in the next few years is what to do with countries that now have the capability and perhaps have an interest in developing nuclear weapons. For the last 40 years or so, the United States has had a kind of free ride because nuclear technology was hard to get, nuclear technology was expensive, and there was a kind of general consensus that nuclear weapons were illegitimate and perhaps even immoral. But I wonder whether the momentum may have shifted just a little bit. Let's not forget that the Iranians are interested in nuclear weapons not only because the State of Israel has nuclear weapons, but also because Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Iran is in a dangerous neighborhood. Iran faces threats and vulnerabilities from all sides. There are United States troops in Afghanistan. There are German troops in Afghanistan today. And if the Iranian government does get nuclear weapons, which is still not quite clear that that's what the Iranians are really interested in. The Saudi government may be interested in nuclear weapons as well. Now, what might the United States do? It seems to me like the Bush administration's current policy is to try to coerce and force countries not to develop nuclear weapons. It's worth asking whether or not forcing countries to give up nuclear weapons is counterproductive. If countries feel vulnerable, if they feel threatened, and they think nuclear weapons is their one last whole card, then threatening military force to stop countries developing nuclear weapons might not work.
Thank you. Another question from our audience.
A question for Mr. Dine. Mr. Dine, you are a prominent Jew, and I do appreciate if you give me an honest answer. Does Israel want peace? Because if it does, I mean, you have to give. You cannot have peace without giving the rights of others. I mean, you know, I am one of the moderates, and I remember when the peace process started, I remember I went to Jordan at that time. Believe me, 90% of people were with the peace process. Now we go, maybe I don't think you'll find 10% of people. I think this policy is not working, and believe me, I think it's doing a lot of harm to the Jews because we always lived together in our lives. So please answer.
Question for Mr. Dine.
Yes, the Israelis want peace. Goodness gracious, would anyone want to live the way it's going? Would anyone want to be surrounded by those who hate them? Would anyone want to always fear another rain of katushas or whatever? Would anyone want to send their sons into the IDF to go to defend the country? This is absolutely counter to any rational behavior. However, if the leaders who are surrounding Israel want to, quote-unquote, kill Jews, eliminate Israel, destroy this, destroy that, you got to defend yourself. And if you don't believe in force and violence, great. The Israelis now have a terrible complex. They withdrew from Lebanon in 2000. They withdrew from Gaza. They want to withdraw from the West Bank. You finally have a prime minister with enough credentials to get the country out of the West Bank. And the whole thing's going the wrong way. So, yes, the Israelis want peace. It's in their songs. It's in the culture. It's in the traditional literature. Why do you think they voted for Olmert? Because he ran on a peace ticket.
Okay. Thank you. Another question from a member of our audience.
Yeah, thank you very much. My question is to Abu Khalil. Do you believe in the right of state of Israel to exist? Thank you.
No, I do not believe in the right of Israel to remain as a state that is premised on inequality between different people on the basis of their religion and race. Just yesterday, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that Arabs in Israel receive less compensation for damage from Katyushas than those who are Jewish citizens of the state. I also am a secular atheist, so I am not a fan of Muslim states, Jewish states, or Christian states. I am opposed in principle to Saudi Arabia, so similarly and logically, I am certainly opposed to a state that is Jewish or Christian.
Okay. Thank you. Another question from our audience.
Yes, and this is to everyone just to respond to this quotation in terms of hope for the future and in terms of hopes for peace. This is a quote from Arnon Sofer, professor of geography at Haifa University, father of Sharon's separation plan, quoted in the Jerusalem Post. He says, when 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will become even bigger animals than they are today with the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam. The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So if we want to remain alive, we'll have to kill and kill and kill all day and every day. If we don't kill, we cease to exist. The only thing that concerns me is how to ensure that the boys and men who are going to have to do all the killing will be able to return to their homes and families and be normal human beings.
How nice.
You know, Professor Nock, can I...
Is this directed toward any...
You know, that kind of language you can find anywhere in any society in the world. You even find it here in San Francisco, where those who are opposed to the existence of Israel or anti-Israel, that's how they demonstrate in front of City Hall, and they did so about a week ago, calling all Jews dogs. Now, if you want to get into name-calling, that's an easy one. We all grew up in schoolyards. We all had to fight our way in some fashion and had to face schoolyard bullies and name-callers and everything. So I suggest a different approach than this kind of recitation.
For the purpose of the audience, I would like to point out that
Professor
this statement is... that this statement is absolutely not unrepresentative. These kind of statements, references to Arabs as barbarians, backwards, as animals. I mean, you have to read Ahad Ha'am, a great Jewish thinker, Zionist, one of the people who modernized the writing of modern Hebrew, who went to the Holy Land early on in the history of Zionist enterprise, and he was appalled at the racism displayed against the native population. Palestinians have been called cockroaches, two-legged animals by Prime Minister Begin, and there are so many others. But it reflects what I said. The premise of the Zionist movement and the state of Israel has been racism towards Arabs in order to justify the onslaught that have been visited against a largely defenseless population.
Yeah, I have to step in
Professor
on this.
Professor Beal?
I mean, it's very convenient, I think, to believe that this is the dominant discourse in Israel that the questioner just quoted. That's very easy, but that's not, in fact, how it works. That is not how the culture generally views the question, for example, of Gaza. Now, there is an important debate within Israel, which is completely occluded by this kind of deviant statement, which has to do with how Israel should respond to Qassam rockets fired over the international border. You know, I happen to believe that the Israeli response to this has been extremely heavy-handed and has not been helpful. In fact, has created a backlash that this kind of heavy bombing, which does kill a lot of civilians, doesn't work. I've stated that already this evening. But there is a debate within Israel about exactly how Israel should react to the Hamas government. And a lot of the voices in this debate, I'm talking about people in the among the political elites, don't talk this way, but understand that this is a population that Israel will have to make peace with in some form or the other. So if we want to really advance our understanding, we can't fall back on this kind of rhetoric. We've heard a lot of rhetoric here tonight that, frankly, I think is completely useless for moving towards the future. I think the state of Israel makes a lot of mistakes and, indeed, even commits a lot of crimes. So do the Arabs. We have to remember, of course, that Hezbollah did not sit on its hands during the recent war. They fired 4,000 rockets at civilian population. So, you know, once we set that aside, then let's talk in good practical terms about how we move forward. And I think that's where the discussion has to go.
Again, a reminder to our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program discussing the current conflict in the Middle East with panelists Professor Asad Abu Khalil of California State University Stanislaus, Professor David Beal of UC Davis, Thomas Dine, Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma Counties, Professor Fred Lawson of Mills College, and Professor Glenn E. Robinson of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Another question from our audience.
Yes, actually, this sort of anticipates or Dr. Beal's comments anticipated my question. Granted that Israel's response has probably hurt Israel worse, how can Israel effectively and legitimately achieve a safe and secure border? I'd like comments from as many of the panelists as possible. First, whether they have a legitimate right after some 80 years of being of having a secure border, and how could they most effectively do this?
Okay, thank you. I'm just urging our panelists to be brief. Shall we just start? Do you want to go first, Professor Abu Khalil?
Well, I think that there's a choice, but I think there was an opportunity back in the 1970s. I am not a fan of a two-state solution because I think that Israel was going to wind up using this idea in order to create little Bantustan that are subjugated by Israeli massive use of violence, as we see in the Bantustan of Gaza today, where 25% of the Palestinian elected Palestinian legislatures are kidnapped by the state of Israel. So with that in mind, I think it's not going to work. I am of the view that what we have and what is going to be secure should be based on idea of equality of Jews and Arabs, where all of them can share in a binational state. Ideas were championed by the likes of Martin Buber, Judas Magnus, and others, Arabs and Jews, in the 1930s who wanted that idea to come to fruition. But certainly Zionism wasn't in the mood for that. And let us not talk about purchase of land, because by 1948, I mean, the Zionists did not even have more than 10% of the land purchased, was taken by conquest. So instead of that, we can have where the two people can share together the land in a secular, binational, democratic state. But my fear is that is going to be far-fetched. Israel has driven the other side to such extremism that the final outcome of this conflict is not going to be to my liking. It's not going to be pleasant. And it's certainly going to jeopardize the idea of coexistence between all the people of the Middle East that I think is important.
Thank you. Professor Beal, and yeah, I urge our panelists to be brief.
When I was a student 35 years ago in Berkeley, we were debating the binational state, and, you know, the binational state is not going to happen, no matter what we think, if we want it or don't want it. The solution is going to be between two nationalisms, Palestinian and Israeli, and the question is on what terms. Now, there are some very important developments happening right now, I think. First of all, there are developments happening among the Palestinians that haven't gotten very much attention. There is a national unity government that is probably going to be formed, which will be in a much better position to negotiate with Israel, assuming Israel is prepared to negotiate. And that is a large question after this war. But I also think that it's possible that a defeat, which is essentially what happened to Israel in this war, could perhaps produce positive results, that Israel might be more ready to negotiate and compromise with the Palestinians than had they won the war. And in fact, to quote you just a historical example, the only Arab-Israeli war which has actually led to a peace agreement was the 1973 war, when the Egyptians felt that they had fought Israel to a draw.
Mr. Dine?
There will be efforts at a two-state solution, because it's the only solution. Whether or not the political leaders on both sides are strong enough, like Anwar Sadat was, because that's the reason there was an agreement after 73, not the war itself, we'll all keep our fingers crossed. But it's you cannot get a solution to the borders, to whatever else is going to be negotiated, if you don't try. And what we've seen for a long time now is a lack of trying.
Despite the fact that chain bookstores are full of studies of negotiation and bargaining and how to do it successfully, I think the scholarly literature on bargaining and negotiation is really not very well developed right at the present time, and especially the study of international bargaining and international negotiations. One of the things it seems to me we see from this existing literature is that the outcomes, the objectives of the bargain, may not be quite as important as the process itself. There are dynamics that take hold once two sides sit down seriously to talk to each other. And one of the things that makes the process work is a kind of respect and a kind of willingness to listen on the part of both sides. So what we certainly need to see between Israel and Syria at the moment is for both sides to respect the other as a legitimate actor and recognize that probably neither one of those sides is going to get very much of what it really wants.
Professor Robinson.
Well, the first and obvious point is that nobody is going to have security without a political solution. There's no military solution to this conflict. It seems to me that, I mean, if one wants to take a broad view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I agree with a couple of the previous speakers who suggested the only reasonable solution that might be reached is a two-state solution, and I certainly would support that. Each side really had to overcome a bugaboo. That's a highly technical term. On the Palestinian side, it was to accept and recognize Israel. as they didn't have to like it. You know, Native Americans didn't have to like the establishment of the United States, and but to accept it and to move on. And at the official level, that's happened. I mean, there has been official recognition in 1993 by the PLO of the State of Israel. Now, at the popular level, it's mostly happened, but there are some big holdouts as well, as we all know. But at the official level, it has happened. On the Israeli side, the bugaboo is to really fully, finally quit the occupation. Not halfway, not mostly, not we'll keep half of your land, you know, these settlements here and there, but really fully, finally quit the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and come to a solution based very closely on the 1967 boundaries. There's not a geographic logic to the 1967 borders, but there's a political and a moral and an ethical and a legal logic to those borders. And that has to be accepted on the Israeli side. And it has not been at the official level, but it has been in many of the popular quarters of Israel. So in my mind, those are the two bugaboos. They're kind of at different levels of acceptance and getting over the hump. But, you know, once those are over the hump, I don't see a reason why we cannot have a successful two-state solution.
Thank you. We're nearing the end of our program, and I have one last somewhat hopeful question for our panelists. Given the time, I'd ask you to limit your response to 30 seconds. The question is, what common ground can you all agree upon, if any, in terms of creating a lasting peace in the region? Professor Abu Khalil.
I mean, it seems to me there should be common grounds about the rejection of violence that's inflicted on civilians, whether on the Israeli side or the Arab side. I mean, I think that's to be axiomatic. Secondly, I think there should be a principle that justice should not in any way disadvantage or advantage one group over another. Thirdly, there should be the notion that all forms of terrorism, whether they are at the hands of groups or by states, should be rejected and considered to be unacceptable. And it seems to me that should be obvious, but it isn't. Because as we saw today, some people want to revise the Geneva Conventions.
Professor Beal.
Yeah, I think that what both sides share in common is each feels that it's a victim. And I think if you can hear the fact that the other side feels like a victim, that might be the first step towards overcoming that and behaving not like a victim.
Mr. Dine.
The most destructive force in the last 200 years in Europe has been nationalism. So the common ground is to find, is to get beyond nationalism to in order to live together.
Professor Lawson.
Being citizens of the United States, we're all imbued with liberalism, and liberals tend to think that agreements are best based on common grounds and shared interests and so on. I'm not sure that common interests and common grounds will provide the basis for a solution in this case.
And Professor Robinson.
I'm going to have to be extra optimistic by comparison there.
I'm in favor of solutions, but they may not be on the basis of common shared values or common shared grounds.
Right. Let me just make this point, and that is that political solutions tend to come out not of the status quo, but of upheaval. And we're clearly in a period of upheaval that could lead to very disastrous results, or it could lead to opportunities for real peace.
Thank you. Our thanks to our panel for their informative remarks. Professor Asad Abu Khalil of the California State University at Stanislaus, Professor David Beal of the University of California at Davis, Mr. Thomas Dine, Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma Counties, Professor Fred Lawson of Mills College, and Professor Glenn Robinson of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Thank you to our audiences here and on the radio. I am Michael Nock, Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.